Do you remember when they released a VCR? This would have been really early 90s. That had the Master System, the Sega Master System. And so it was a it might have been like an Akai or something like that. So it was a VCR, but it had a Master System built into it.
That's insane.
It would be worth
incredible,
ridiculous amounts of cash now.
Think. I mean, you know, think of how much a Super Nintendo's worth. Imagine how much that would be worth.
Yeah, that.
Do you remember the classic 80s video store? Like, every video had the Sega trailer at the front of it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So good.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
See Alex the Kid and all of those here.
Yeah.
Because they were Sega really pushed for, you know, let's get into rental, let's
Sega
do it.
Dominated like for a long time.
They went for it. They went, okay, yeah, this is a really smart decision.
I miss video stores.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
You've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm gonna amp this baby up. See how it sounds.
Shut your hole, you little dyke!
Hey, cheers for listening. This is, of course, the FakeShimp.net podcast. My name's Glenn.
I'm Jarrett.
This is Sean.
You can help us out a great deal by liking us on Facebook, listening to us on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher. Give us a rating. A rating helps a lot. Let's get started. If this episode sounds any different, it's because we're coming from an exotic location, also known as Sean's place.
We've got some natural light, too.
It's weird, isn't it? We're not in a bunker basement.
And we're not recording it at, like, you know, 10 o'clock at night. This is an afternoon recording.
Afternoon delight.
This is nice.
So if it does sound different, that is why. We're somewhere else, somewhere different. And this episode, we've got a feature film. We've got the usual stuff to get through. Anyone got anything they want to discuss off the bat?
Yep.
Okay.
No, go.
I was just going to mention that last week was Fitzroy Film Fair. And we had a stall there. It was the biggest Fitzroy Film Fair yet.
Yep.
We did good trade and we met a lot of great people. We were handing out cards and talking about films. And it was great. There was people that were buying things from us, like our old DVDs of like the Goonies, because their partners hadn't seen them. And they were introducing them to, you know, films that they grew up on that their partners hadn't seen. And we were just having an amazing time. Like, so many great conversations. And it wasn't just, you know, the average punter. There was filmmakers, label owners. Everyone was there.
It was great. And thank you to everyone that came up to us and had a conversation and purchased from us.
Totally.
We were surprised. And we gave out a hell of a lot of cards.
There was a lot of cards given.
So if you're a new listener to this podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. Well, a few things that happened since our last podcast. A few interviews have gone up on the website. We've got an interview with Patrick Kennelly, who did Excess Flesh. Joseph Sims Dennett, who made Observance. That got screened last week.
Yes.
And Heath Davis, whose new film Broke is going across the country. And so we haven't had interviews on our website for quite a while. It's good to have them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Claptrap?
Claptrap.
Claptrap? Is that the interview portion?
No, like picking brains.
Picking brains, sorry. What's the claptrap again?
Claptrap is everything else.
Right, okay. Well, that makes sense.
Well, you know what the meaning of claptrap is.
Oh, my God.
Well, I was just like, I remember claptrap on the site, and I don't know how, where that sort of fit in.
Oh, there you go. Right. I haven't seen anything. I'm very keen to see Jungle Book got a release this week.
Well,
I know that you had some issues with
it. I still haven't seen it because fucking issues, yeah.
Right.
I went into a cinema, and it was school holidays. I was expecting parents with kids, obviously. I like that. You see a kids movie, to have kids react is good.
Yeah.
But the row I was sitting in was a group of 20. There were two mothers and 18 kids. It was a party. None of them watched the movie. They spoke just to each other throughout the whole thing. Yep. The mothers decided to put plastic shopping bags in front of my feet rather than any of the other 20 chairs.
Right.
And they thought that 5 minutes into the film was a good time to stand up in front of me and rummage through these and allocate each child their lolly bags and like that.
Wow. Oh my God.
And asked them if they could please stop because I was trying to watch the film, and she says, well, that's your problem. So I just...
That's your problem for being in a cinema wanting to watch a movie.
Yeah. So I just got
fuck you, Glenn.
And I left and I haven't been back to see it.
Which cinema, like, is this?
Hoyts.
Okay, right.
Major cool. Complex.
All right, big one, yeah.
And this is the one film, if you've listened to our podcast, I've been anticipating this film all year long.
Yeah.
And I was just so fucking devastated that I had to walk out.
Everybody knows my rule about going to the cinema when you're eating. Nothing louder than marshmallows from a pillowcase.
Yeah, that's right.
That's it. It's because it's for anything other than just decency to everybody else.
Absolutely.
I didn't pay $25 to come and listen to you rummage through bags. Mm-hmm. And I've been in the exact same position. I remember I went to see Apocalypse Now at the Astor. beautiful re-release of the film, and it was packed cinema. Guy comes down, sits down next to me, sits for two and a half, three hours. I was like, the guy just paid $20 to come into a dark room and open fucking crisps for 2.5 hours.
God.
It's so inconsiderate.
It actually takes me back to the Melbourne Underground Film Festival screening for the fake Shemp Double, and we had a patron that came along. We've since spotted another screening.
Yeah.
But he sat there and proceeded to unpack the contents of his backpack.
That's right.
Which was a sort of different food. You were there too. Yeah,
yeah, there.
and even during the Q&A at one point, he was unpacking things. Unreal. You're like, dude, just give it a rest.
Yeah. It's so inconsiderate.
And now you've got cinemas in America experimenting with inviting people to use their phones in film sessions.
Yeah.
This is outrageous.
It's crazy. Because the situation in America, I mean, like, I know you used to live in Canada. I don't know what the situation with the cinemas in Canada. But certainly in America, when I lived there, it's a real issue. The people just have, they take this attitude of, hey, well, I paid money, so I can do whatever I like. And it's... And people get shot in cinemas in America because of, you know, arguments started over things like rustling crisp packets.
Well, you know, having a group of 20 in my row doing that, you can see why people get shot. It makes you that goddamn furious. Yeah. It goes through your mind.
Boiled blood. Well, you haven't seen it, but the good news is... You've seen it. I haven't. I would really like to see it.
Yeah.
Anything that Jon Favreau does, I'm a fan of. You know, particularly after Chef. Chef struck a real chord with me. Obviously, all the way back to Swingers and all that kind of stuff. But Jungle Book is killing it at the box office, which strikes me as odd because outside of a couple of billboards, I didn't see anything about it.
Yeah, the marketing. I mean, they went pretty hard on the television marketing in the States. I don't know because I don't watch a lot of free-to-air broadcasts here. But... yeah, I don't know where the money's sort of been spent. Yeah, I know that it has been a long time coming, and so they've been teasing. So I think people have possibly seen the trailers prior to films in cinemas.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of been a weird sort of grassroots approach with it.
But yeah, I think it's...
And you're playing on a name, so I mean, it is, I guess it's established. It's you know, a classic cartoon. It's a classic
Well, plus,
novel.
Like, I mean, Disney now is... They're pumping these things out. It's like a renaissance for Disney, like what they're doing, and they've got so many more to come. I think Pete's Dragon's coming out later this year.
Yep.
Looks really good.
Is there a trailer up for
that?
Yeah,
a teaser. And there's a teaser poster that's amazing.
It
kind of looks like Where the Wild Things Are. It's got that.
Well, there's infinite possibilities with their catalogue. I mean, outside, obviously, you know, your Lady and the Tramp and stuff, Sword in the Stone. There's so many
cool
films.
That's
coming.
They're
doing that?
The Beauty and the Beast next year.
Yes, Beauty and the
Little
Beast.
Mermaid.
I was reading about that.
Little Mermaid. There's a whole lot, but it's fantastic because so far so good. Like Cinderella was amazing, and Maleficent was great, and you know,
Into the Woods.
No. But that wasn't a live action adaptation of anything.
No, it was a stage show
that they brought to the screen, so it wasn't like there was a cartoon to base that off. But, you know, anyway.
But yeah, so I mean, Jungle Book, huge news for Jungle Book. It's really good success for Jon Favreau. Happy to hear it.
Yep.
Other news. Production has started on the American remake of the anime Ghost in the Shell, starring Scarlett Johansson.
A little bit of criticism.
I was going to say, have you heard the controversy over already?
No, I've been watching it, but I haven't been reading half the articles.
So it's been directed by this guy, Rupert Sanders. The last thing he did was the first Snow White and the Huntsman.
So
he's used to big budget territory. You know, this one's obviously got Scarlett Johansson, co-stars Michael Pitt. However, all of a sudden, much like Alex Proyas in Gods of Egypt, the studios have started to backtrack a little bit on their casting decision. They're afraid that they're going to be claimed as whitewashing a largely Japanese story. So they've started using visual effects to experiment with making, swear to God, Scarlett Johansson look more Asian. To try and mitigate the problem on the back
end.
It's
like Jim Sturgess in bloody Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, exactly.
That was controversial.
Particularly given that the last couple of months after the release of Gods of Egypt, and Alex Proyas, months before the film was even released, came out and apologised for whitewashing it.
It seems like
it's going to be a common
thing. I'm really tired of these studios second guessing or backtracking. Like, just fucking commit to something and live with it.
Yeah, exactly. For better or worse, live with it. In the first place, my attitude is, in the first place, just do it properly.
Yeah.
Then you don't have to deal with this shit.
Correct.
Like you know, if it's a sensitive issue, which it obviously is, and for right reasons, then don't dig the hole.
Okay, but then you've got the argument that a lot of Japanese animation make their characters look westernized. They give them wide eyes, and you know.
Well, they do. I mean, you know, that's a podcast in itself. The expression that we learned when we were studying it in VCA was Jesus didn't happen in Japan, but World War II did, and it's that kind of it's a bizarre scenario to be using an anime of all things as a reference point to whether you're whitewashing or not, because the lines seem to be blurred from the start. But at the same time, you know, I think it might be a punch in a much bigger fight. So I don't know.
We'll be interesting to watch it play out. Rogue One, the trailer dropped.
Yeah, incredible.
You know what? I had a really strong emotional reaction to this, more than I did with The Force Awakens.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. It really it was a really powerful.
Yeah, it was really emotive. The use of the score throughout the film and the sort of revisionist score that they did with the classic Star Wars theme music, it just immediately shivers up the spine.
And it's an exciting direction. Like, we're off that original narrative, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
All bets are off. They can do what they want.
Well, that's it. Now we're forming part of a story of where we know it's going, but we're going to see the genesis of how that kind of came about.
Can I be a heathen?
Yeah.
I just couldn't care less.
Well, but you were that way with Force Awakens.
I was. And to be fair, Force Awakens really swayed me. But the fact that Rogue One is now coming out, and it does look, to its credit, it looks incredible, right? It really looks spectacular. But we're not even a year out from the last Star Wars. We're already getting done with the second
Star Wars. But that's the point. They're doing one per year.
I know. But then, I mean, like, so then if we've got Star Wars coming out, one, probably if the studios had their way, two a year, you know, in the near future, expanding that universe, then we get Marvel superheroes on the other hand. I mean, like, it just feels like we're being pasteurized. Like,
I'm feeling pretty good about it.
I'm feeling great about it. And like, that kind of contradicts what you spoke about off mic before. We were talking about
superheroes,
you know, dominating the screens, and we were saying, well, who cares? Like, there's plenty of other cinema out there.
Oh, that's true. That is true.
I'm also feeling too that Disney are doing it right, and they know they're learning from the errors that they say Fox has made, and that with everything from the prequels of Star Wars right to, you know, Fantastic Four and things like that. They appreciate that the audience now want quality.
Yeah,
and I feel like they're bringing it. Like, look at the new Marvel trailers. Like the new Captain America looks supposed to be incredible. Fantastic. Yeah. Doctor Strange trailer was released the other day.
Doctor Strange looks just like a Inception ripoff so far, doesn't it? I mean, the teaser trailer that dropped.
I'm excited.
I'm waiting for it. Yeah. I'm excited. And people that argue that it's Star Wars saturation, well, it's only one film a year. It's not saturation.
I have plenty of room. But you know, in my world to watch as many movies as I can, and these are tentpole films. They're not stealing anything from the smaller India, you know, films that I would see throughout the year. So,
Speaking of saturation, 4 Avatar sequels have just been announced.
I know. Has it been like 6 or 7 years since the last?
It's going on 10.
I think it's 2006 almost
2006. Doesn't sound right.
I was in film school. I was in first year.
2010, I'd say. 2009.
2008.
Yeah, 2008. Seeing this at IMAX.
I know. I'm right, because my first year lecturer gave me an advanced screening pass to it, so it was 2008. But 4 sequels. To a rubbish, I mean, like, technologically.
Well, hang on, let's not start this argument.
Four sequel. I mean, like, this is James Cameron signing off to the rest of his career.
Yeah. Well, he's already said that. He says, the rest of my career is Avatar.
Which is heartbreaking, because just prior to Genesis, because the rights expire and they go back to Cameron for the Terminator franchise, and there was talk that he would take Terminator back and do something.
I can't see him doing that.
Just fucking release True Lies and The Abyss on Blu-ray, James. Because you said you were holding off doing it because you wanted to do 3D versions of them. No one cares. We just want them on Blu-ray.
The one thing that does excite me about the Avatar, I mean, it's not something I'm going to do backflips about, but they're going to be individual stories. They're not continuations of previous films. So they're all isolated stories.
Does this mean that old mate fucking Sam Worthington's not going to get the phone call?
Well, he won't be in all 4, that's a guarantee.
Right, okay.
With any luck.
I think one of them is rumoured to be like an underwater film, you know.
Okay.
A lot of possibilities there, but each of them on a different moon.
Right.
So they will all make up a saga, but not necessarily
one. So we'll have different aliens, so they won't all be blue aliens. No. I like that concept. Yeah. I guess then he can build his own universe to then do a movie where he brings them all into one.
And yet then...
And Disney will produce it.
And yet then James... And then,
two films a year.
But then James Cameron goes and says, I'll see you all on Pandora. So
that was his
tease. So I don't know what the fuck's going on. Anyway. Yeah,
big week for news.
Big week. Should we move to a focus film?
Let's do it.
Class of 1984.
Life is pain. Pain is everything.
Somebody's got to stop this insanity.
If they are the future, who will stop them? Class of 1984, rated R.
Opening next Friday at a theater or drive-in.
So there we go, Class of 1984. Jarrett brought this one to the table.
Indeed I did, sir. It's a childhood classic. I used to watch it with my sister growing up. She was a big Michael J. Fox fan in the
Back
day.
Back that up, it's a childhood classic.
It's one I grew up on. And the main thing was that Michael J. Fox was in it for her. And we used to watch this back-to-back with Poison Ivy as kids.
Two totally different films.
Two completely different
films. Let's just backtrack. It's a Class of 1984, directed by Mark Lester, written by Tom Holland.
Correct.
Co-written by Tom Holland. Tell us a bit about it, Jarrett.
Well, basically, it's the tale of a teacher, a naive teacher from Nebraska, who moves to a real sort of blackboard jungle-style school in the city, where the kids are just raucous and not willing to learn, and more, I don't know, what would you say... drug-addled.
They're just fucking reckless degenerates.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They're the kids of today, essentially. They're the kids of today.
It was one of those fearful premonition, kind of movies. Mm. This is what our future is like.
Absolutely.
No.
It didn't take long. Probably only, 10 years down the track.
Yeah. And I mean,
it was released in 1982. So by the time the mid-90s rolled around, this kind of, you get a feeling, I'd never seen it until we watched it just then. And it's the precursor to all those. There was, remember in the mid-90s, there was a big spate of those films.
Yeah.
There was Dangerous Minds, there was A Substitute, there was 187, which is, this is obviously the precursor.
But you go back
to,
before that. You got Lean On Me and you got The Principal, which I think Principal's the pinnacle for these
Principal's
kind of films.
Really,
fucking
amazing. And even beyond that as well, I mean, to a lesser degree, To Sir With Love and stuff. You could see that would be the pitch to this, To Sir With Love, but with hyper-violence.
And as Jarrett referenced, it all began with Blackboard Jungle. And from there on, Goodbye Mr. Chips, I suppose, to some extent.
True.
So there's a... this kind of film, there's so many of them, but I think this one and The Principal are the two that push the limits with it, that's really badass.
It was very confronting.
And it's not a story about overcome their underprivileged backgrounds and
let's not right the wrongs.
That's right. This is like they're fucking terrible people and the authority figures are going to get their own. And, and this film is probably more extreme than The Principal. They have very similar... Mm. overridings on narratives, particularly with the finale.
Yeah.
But this one really pushes the envelope.
Absolutely.
It is that kind of typical Mark Lester attitude and direction towards his films where there is no... And I think it's probably a thing from when he was making films, between now and by the 1990s that rolled around. Mark Lester was one of these sort of hot dog action film directors. But the commonality they all had in... thematically was they were all just good guys were good, bad guys were bad, and there was no middle ground, which was typical for the 80s as well.
Yeah.
But this is just like that. The bad kids are exceptionally bad. There's no redeeming qualities.
No, not at all.
There's no slivers of hope in any one of them. Mm. And all the good guys are overwhelmingly good.
No moral ambiguity whatsoever.
No, it's just clear cut, black hat, white hat, and there's no middle ground.
Yeah.
And that leads to with that lack of grey area, it just leads to brutality. It just leads to insane
just
violence.
Whack swastikas on them.
Absolutely.
Which all these bad guys have at some point in time. Yeah. And it's just absolutely brutal. And for like as a 1980s film, it's kind of got this weird heightened reality about it.
Mm.
Like the blood, half the time the blood's like fluoro pink.
I
love that though. Like it's a real sign of the time. It makes it a period piece, if you will. Oh, fuck. And this is Mark Lester's favourite film of all the films he's made.
I read that.
Really?
And this is the guy that's made bloody Commando Firestarter Showdown in Little Tokyo.
Yeah.
We won't mention Poseidon Rex and Pterodactyl.
Pretty much his career in the 90s was essentially B-grade sort of action movies, really, after Showdown. Was it Showdown Little Tokyo he directed?
Decent film.
And after that, it was everything he made sort of starred Angie Everhart, Ice Cube, or William Baldwin or something Eric Roberts' favourite director or something. It's weird because I feel like the Class of 1984 seems to have a real solid cult following. but I'm not exactly sure why. I can't work it out. I've been sitting thinking about it. It came in the early 80s, and the way everybody dresses, it's kind of prophetic of the pastiche idea of the 80s that we would then have by the time the late 80s, 90s rolled around, even though that's not really how kids in the 80s dressed. It forecasts the violence and the degradation that, you know, occurs in schools 10, 15 years before it happened. And I don't know if it's maybe at the time it was tapping into some kind of cultural zeitgeist that it was foreshadowing. And
you know, I don't think it did, though.
But I could be wrong.
I think its cult following is much like The Warriors. Like, it appealed to that generation particularly. I don't think the overall message of the film was what resonated. I think the fact the viewers were that age and it was cool to watch. Absolutely. School in disarray.
Exactly. We hadn't seen anything like that. And as bad as the bad guys are, they look pretty fucking cool. And I still think that
it's true.
To this day, because it had that very late 70s, early 80s, you know, punk look.
Yeah, they were wearing costumes, particularly the girl. You know, like, she would, at the end, the finale, she was dressed like a dragon.
Yeah, it's very iconic. It's representative in the poster.
It spoke to his generation. Yeah. It wasn't like trying to. It was a heightened reality of something we all recognized in some way. We all had bullies in school, and this sort of was the bullies getting their, you know, their comeuppance, you know, which is something we all wanted to happen.
Yeah,
you know, so that's where the cult following probably lies.
Yeah, is it worthwhile mentioning the sequels before, you know?
Well, I was going to mention them anyway, because he did follow it up with Class of 99.
Does Class of 99, I mean, I haven't seen Class of 99 either. Does Class of 99, is it just a retread, or is
it... No, it gets very strange, because it almost becomes a science fiction film, because...
Yeah, it is a science fiction
film. The teachers are androids in it, and you got, you know, it's a great throwback in a way to late 70s, early 80s movies, because you got, you know, actors like Pam Grier, who weren't getting a lot of gigs in the late 80s, early 90s at that point, you know, playing these really tough teacher roles. But it's almost like a reversal. You have the teachers that are fucking ridiculous.
And it was cashing in on the popularity of the cyborg movies.
Absolutely, right? So, it was Terminator, cyborg.
Yeah. So it's a completely different kind of film. I like it a lot.
I think it's cool, good.
And then they made Class of 99 too with Sacha Mitchell. Sacha Mitchell was... But that one wasn't sci-fi. That one... Kind of a little bit, but it was more going back to the substitute style movies with Tom Berenger, kind of thing. Yeah. So it was an interesting sequel to a sequel
that
has nothing to do with the original.
The sequel, just Class of 99, does it kind of feed in and of itself of the first one?
Is it the same universe?
Well, yeah. I mean, is it the same universe? But more so, does it recognize how pastiche that the original perhaps was, and then plays on it, so it becomes like this?
It looks
snake
nothing like
its tail.
It's almost completely independent. I think it was trading on title alone.
Right.
Okay. You know, it feels like it was title alone, and title even then, director, it seems kind of odd, because, you know, it came out, well, it was made in 89, so roughly here, we think maybe about 91, 92, it came out. It almost feels kind of like it was.
And I think that the first one was like a sort of a forecast into the near future. This one's a forecast into the distant future,
kind
of thing.
They went for 2 years previously. We went for 10.
Yeah.
We digress a little bit. Let's bring it back to
an interesting fact that I read about is that one of the writers, Barry Schneider, removed his name from the film because he was appalled at how violent it turned out to be. Thinking, you fucking wrote that violence. Like,
absolutely.
The reason it's violent is because of you.
It was inherent, obviously. Well, I haven't read the script, but assumedly from the script. And that would have been the elements that sold it.
Yeah.
You know, that got funding. Was like, okay, so you're just making this type of movie again, but we've got this and we've got that. No spoilers.
No spoilers.
But
no spoilers.
We've got Alice Cooper on the soundtrack.
No, oh, that's true.
I Am the Future. Yes. What a track. The movie opens with it. Incredible.
You couldn't stop singing that, could you?
It's forever in my head. I got it on 7-inch. I fucking love it. And the opening line to that song, "When does a dream become a nightmare?" Oh, Alice. I actually don't think he wrote it. He just sang
Be
it.
He's still my beating heart. It's curious to note that there's very few people that ended up in the production that went on to do anything else. You know, Mark L. Lesser obviously had a career, if it was only for about 10 or 15 years. He's still making
Tom
films.
Tom Holland.
I think it's curious that the bad guy, what's his name?
Timothy Van Patten.
What's the character's name?
Steak Stegman.
Stegman, the guy that always talks in third person. He seems to be the guy.
Yeah.
The most unlikely success of the lot. Mm. He's now obviously directing. He's one of the HBO go-to guys. He's directed everything from The Sopranos to Boardwalk Empire. Why? I wonder why there's nobody that came out of this film unscathed. Like, it's because for a film that has the cult following it does, or is it just another version of, I mean, The Evil Dead is the same. There's only one person that came out of Evil Dead doing all right. Sure. The rest of the woman from The Evil Dead, so what is it about cult films like this that it's just a one-off flash?
Slow traction, maybe.
I think it's the time. I think that the film may have been successful as like a drive-in double feature or a 42nd feature, a 42nd Street feature. But at the time, it didn't really do much in terms of getting them other gigs until it grew on Home End.
It built its following, yeah.
And then I think the people that grew up with these films and loved them, they're the people that hire them for their,
nostalgia roles value.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it feels... And I mean, at that point in time, these were the films that actors did to kind of just make money. I don't think they ever thought that these were going to be the roles that would break them into the industry.
It's American theatrical run. This was the supplementary film on the double bill. It came after Mad Max 2 in a lot of screenings.
Really?
So you get Mad Max 2 and this would be the bonus film, So
that,
I think...
See, that makes more sense. Yeah. That sort of helps to align where the film probably lies in a lot of people's hearts, because there's so many of those films, the second feature, go all the way back to the 50s sci-fi films they're the ones that end up having the longevity but are the flash in the pans as well.
It's funny you mentioned that this the bad guy in this, what's his name?
Stegman.
That he went on to become a very prominent director in television. We were talking earlier about a similar film called Dangerously Close, which had John Stockwell,
yeah,
who's gone on to become a really big director.
He makes some really solid films. I really like John. He makes some utter garbage, don't get me wrong, but yeah.
But
yeah,
it's interesting that these films have produced that kind of
lineage for talent. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
It is.
Just out of curiosity, why did you pick a Glenn?
Jarrett,
why did you pick this?
Well, the reason I picked it was because Jarrett suggested it.
it's a good question. Well, it's actually finally coming out in Australia on Blu-ray this week through Glass Doll Films, which, I'm stoked about, because they've put together a really nice special edition. It may be superior to the US release. And, I thought, it's topical. And I looked at the last kind of couple films we've done. I think the last one we did was Pontypool, which was a little bit, sort of further out there, a real sort of underrated, unknown film. Prior to that, we did For Your Consideration. I thought, let's go for something that, it's topical because it's getting a release, but something that's a little bit more culty. Yeah.
This certainly fits the Fake Champ mold a little bit more than the previous
few. Absolutely. This is spot. This is exactly the stuff that we live for.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to mention that this film actually had distribution problems in the States. They managed to sell the film internationally before they got a US deal, which may even factor into the fact, it ended up as a B movie, drive-in fodder and that. And subsequently, in terms of the cast not getting other gigs as well, I think it actually did get an international release before its, US release. Then subsequently, because the business it did on Home End, you had other films come out like, Class of Newcombe High, which was originally just called Newcombe High, but they had tagged on the Class of because of the success of this particular film.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, before we move on, what's your favourite unruly classroom movie?
Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy. Favourite unruly... I've got to say The Substitute.
Yep.
The Tom Berenger one.
Yeah.
I'm a sucker for Tom Berenger. And it just came out at the right time when I was really starting to get into film in a big way. And,
it's quite underrated, that one.
It's really underrated.
Even the sequels are good.
Wow.
I think they are. Treat Williams.
But there was four of them, wasn't there?
I didn't see the fourth one.
Four of them. But even the poster art for the original Substitute, Tom Berenger standing in front of the chalkboard. With all the mathematics. Treat Williams was leaning, but Tom Berenger had his arms behind his back and it was like a big Uzi 9mm, silenced Uzi 9mm on the desk in front of him. And it's just a great poster.
It was a great poster.
I think I would say Substitute.
Yeah, what about you?
Well, it's going to have to be Class of 94.
And I'll go for The Principal.
The Principal, just clarify, the Principal is James Belushi, isn't it?
Yeah, Luke Gossett Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, so good.
Yeah, who directed that?
Sydney J. Fury or something like that.
No. Christopher Kane.
Christopher Kane.
Yeah, Young Guns fame.
Ah, right.
And Fortress 2.
That was
Jeff Murphy.
Right.
I digress. All right, moving on.
Moving on.
Sit on this, motherfucker.
What's the matter with you?
What's the matter with you? What's the matter with me?
What's the matter with matter?
All right, obscurities. So the films that came and went, flew under the radar, didn't get the recognition they deserved. How about that?
Sounds perfect.
Boom! I wish it was that simple every week. Who wants to go first?
Jared does, obviously.
Yeah.
God, I couldn't spit out Sean's name fast enough. Okay, so my film is actually quite recent. It was made in 2014, but it's only getting a physical release next week here in Australia. So it came out in November 2014.
It was almost my film. I'm like, oh no, we've done the same one because mine's 2014 as well.
Right, yeah. So
yours is so obscure, it hasn't been released yet.
Pretty much in Australia.
That's pretty obscure.
Had a US release in November 2014, came out early 2015 in the UK, and it's such a... It should have been a big film, but it wasn't.
Did we play the guessing game?
That's what I'm about to say. Okay. Did you want to play the guessing game?
I love the guessing game.
I dare say neither of you guys have seen this film.
I dare say you should just stow it just in case.
Okay.
You don't want to make yourself
drip,
look stupid.
No, just drip some info.
Okay. The lead actor in this film, Patrick Wilson.
Yes.
I know exactly what it is.
We've talked about this one.
It came up in rapid fire back in 2014 when I watched it. Because I watched it streamed on Netflix
in
the US.
I don't remember the name of it, though.
I know exactly what it is.
Tell us, because we know what it is.
So the film, it's Stretch.
Stretch, Joel Carnahan, of course.
He directed Narc, The A-Team. What else did he direct? Shooting Aces?
Smoking Aces. Yeah, The Grey
as well.
And
directed The Grey, yeah.
He's one of, in my humble opinion, he's one of the most exciting directors going around today.
In fact, before you launch into it, I think realword.net have a competition with this one at the moment.
Right, to win it on DVD.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's coming out finally in Australia on DVD. Now, it's produced by Universal Pictures and Blumhouse in the United States, and there's a whole story behind that. But
I was
going to
say, the Blumhouse production model is a podcast in itself.
Absolutely.
Because
sure,
it almost works and it almost doesn't work at the same time. It is such a bizarre scenario. If anybody out there listening doesn't know about the Blumhouse, B-L-O-O-M, Blumhouse, it is well worth looking into. And Stretch, for my money, is probably the film that suffered the most from this insane way of funding films. Anyway,
absolutely.
Keep going.
Yeah, that's it, because this film cost $5 million to make, and that's because Carnahan can actually stretch the budget and make it, no pun intended, and make it work for the money. But Universal weren't too sold on the fact that they'd probably have to spend about, you know, four times that to market it, and especially when it didn't have like a heavy lead. You know, Patrick Wilson's known, and he's, you know, great actor, one of my favorite contemporary actors, but he isn't a name that really sells a movie.
Yeah.
So spending 20 mil to market this, you know, this type of film, they didn't sort of see the value in it. In fact, with this particular picture, they had a release date, and then 2 months out from its release date, which was like March 21st, 2014, they pulled it. They pulled the date and then decided they wanted to sell the film to another studio.
Yeah.
So they tried to sell it, but I think the price that they were looking for, no one took it. They ended up releasing it themselves November 2014. They did it to, you know, VOD, SVOD, and DVD. Mm. Only DVD, which fucking sucks because films looks amazing and should be on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So they couldn't sell it, so they just dumped it that way. International territories, they released in the UK through Universal, and then now it's finally surfacing in Australia. In fact, it was supposed to be released last year by Universal on DVD and Blu-ray here in Australia. Then 2 months out from its release, they pulled it from their submission form to retailers because they cited loss of rights. I'm like, how did they lose rights to this? It's their fucking film. They sold it to E1 for Australian and New Zealand distribution.
Right.
So it's only coming out now next week here in Australia through E1. It's only coming out on DVD.
Bare bones?
It's been bare bones everywhere in the world. I actually picked it up in the UK on Blu-ray, which outside of Germany is about the only territory in the world that's had this film released on Blu-ray, which is a sin considering how incredible and stylish this film looks and benefits from, like, you know, a digital audio track.
Wow. But Let you take a breath. Because that was like...
Yeah. That was insane. That was like an encyclopedia worth of fucking information on one film's distribution.
Absolutely. And I didn't read a thing off my
notes.
So
now I want to know what it's about.
Okay, so this is the basic story. Kevin Stretch, who's played by Patrick Wilson, he's a down-and-out Hollywood limo driver who, in order to pay back a $6,000 gambling debt, must embark on one crazy night of driving that'll see him encounter Hollywood actors, American Idol rejects, the Russian mafia, the Chinese underground, practically any kind of hurdle he'll, you know, have in his way to get through the night and to get that $6,000. This film is very much in the fashion of Scorsese's After Hours, all those kind of you know, crazy night type movies where they happen in a small span of time. Michael Mann's Collateral, I say that because we've got the Michael Mann collection right behind me. And I love those type of films where it's almost very real time.
It's a microcosm of a night. It's
beautiful because it feels like there's never a dull second. There's always something happening and you're hanging on the next moment. It's fast paced. It's so stylish. Like, it's really well shot.
It's and God damn it, it's funny.
It's so funny. It's this movie is so funny. So you've seen this film?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Oh my
God,
thank Christ. Someone's seen
it. I mean, like, I've seen it. I've seen it illegally, I will say that. Like, I've seen it illegally. But there's some, I mean, not just dialogue, you know, repartee. Like, it's it's really tight dialogue. It's so really tight. Well directed. But the visual comedy as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's moments, you know, the moment where he's trying to like change the license plate of the car, the car just drives away, and it cracks me up. Like, it is
simple, but done really effectively.
I agree, really.
And that this is the mind blower, because when I first watched it, as I mentioned in Rapid Fire back in November 2014, was I'd been hanging to see this movie and followed all these distribution issues. One day I just turned on my Netflix and it was US Netflix I had it switched to, and it came up in the latest release, and I turned to Danny and went, this film's been released. But it's just on Netflix now. And I'm like, we watch it right now. We watch it right now. And we watched it, and I was thinking in my head, this is a great first 5 minutes. This is the great first 10 minutes. I'm just waiting for the film to turn to shit, because it's got to, because why would Universal try and dump this thing? It didn't. It was great. And then revisiting it this morning, I fucking loved it just as much. If anything, I was picking up on little bits and pieces that I either laughed through or I was just sort of overwhelmed the first time and saw the second time around. It is a tight fucking film that just hasn't got the due attention it has. And Joe Carnahan actually was on Twitter when it was going through all the distribution problems, and he basically said, this is what's happened, this is what's happened. I really believe in this film. I believe Patrick Wilson's amazing. And sure, he's selling the movie, but he actually, he did say, he goes, and this is something to go on record for when you put it on the public forum. He said, this film, I believe, is as good as any other film that I have ever made. This may even be my best film. And one day, hopefully you'll all get to see it. And I mean, that's on record. And I think it is. I mean, because it's a different film. It's probably more akin to Smoking Aces than the other films.
It's an odd film in that Joe Carnahan oscillates, in my opinion. He's one of my heroes, right? I think the guy's just no bullshit. And I really appreciate that, listening to film directors. In fact, there's a great series of interviews on YouTube between Joe Carnahan and the guy that directed Some Guy Who Kills People.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
He interviews Joe Carnahan, and the interview goes for about, you know, combined of all the parts strung together.
Jack Perez.
Right. It goes for about 45 minutes, and it's great. It's just a no bullshit interview with Joe Carnahan, right? But he oscillates between being either this stretch or the A-Team or Smoking Aces, buoyant, uber stylish, hyper violent, you know, fun films, to this kind of John Cassavetes-esque,
absolutely
masculine narc or the gray or something like that. But Stretch, certainly, as far as, you know, he's kind of like Kevin Smith. Take away all of his money and he just gets relied on pure skill.
Totally.
And Stretch is like that. Stretch is, I really like the A-Team. The A-Team, you know, was the Phoenix that came out of the ashes of Mission Impossible 3. But he was originally supposed to direct Mission Impossible 3, and it all fell to pieces, and he had to get it out of his system. And I don't think it's as good a film as Mission Impossible 3, but I think it's a much better film than people would have you think it
Absolutely.
Is. But Stretch is way better.
Hence, than Obscurity.
And Obscurity. I will just add to, there is that parallel with Scorsese, because you have Scorsese that can do these, you know, these brilliant sort of, you know, pieces, gangster pieces, and then do something like, you know, After Hours, and it's very much the same, you know, really sort of style, but a really good balance of style and substance. Like, you can tell Carnahan's a massive film aficionado. Like, this guy has grown up and loves cinema, has such a great understanding of how a film works, because you watch it and you're just like, I'm just constantly being entertained and floored by every sort of aspect of it. But yes, sir, it is an obscurity. So who's up next?
Oh, take a breath. I'll go next.
All right, cool.
So mine's also 2014. I'm going to have to go straight to the director.
Okay.
It's the only thing I can think.
That's going
to
be tough, right?
All right. Director is Joe Lynch, who directed Wrong Turn 2 and Knights of Badassdom. Starring Salma Hayek.
Oh, it's the girl's name.
Everly.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think this
blew me away. This film came out.
Because the cover looked very Sin City. That was what put me off a bit because they went for that black and white red.
It's nothing like Sin City. It slipped under the radar. Never got the critical acclaim it deserved.
Straight to DVD.
Yeah. It's an ultra-violent film. It's a story about a prostitute who works for a crime boss, and she's kidnapped and held captive and then tortured to a pulp in one apartment when the boss finds out she's working for the cops trying to bring him down.
Right.
And when the boss finds out and tortures her, he then sends in killer after killer to try and kill her.
Okay.
But she's hidden weapons all over the place, hundreds of weapons, you know, in the most obscure places, and no one can fuck with her.
Yeah.
It is just, the whole film is set in one room, and it is just a bloodbath.
It's absolute
bloodbath. Yeah. If you can think of Machete meets Kill Bill meets Old Boy, it's like this highly stylized action piece of blood, guts.
It's mayhem.
Bones crunch, and it is this really, really highly stylized. It's really tongue-in-cheek. It's really facetious in its style. And she is a kick-ass action hero. And Everly is just this fucking amazing film. If you've never seen it, it's just one room, one chick, and a whole lot of guys getting brutalized.
It was released with absolutely no fanfare, which is an odd thing because the script has been kicking around Hollywood since 2010.
It was on the blacklist in
2011. Yeah. The best scripts that were never produced, and it's even with its addition to the blacklist, it still sat. The script itself sat in obscurity for 3 years.
I think it's a script that never got produced, and it's so good. And I think it never got produced because no one could work out how to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. It's
one of those ones where, in a real world, it would never happen. Like, Everly's apartment is huge. Like,
it's a fantasy film.
But that's exactly right. It is a fantasy film. Yeah. So it's you've got to buy into the conceit of this. I mean, like, Salma Hayek, she's like amazingly ass kicking in it. Yeah. Like Tomb Raider, be damned. But you get this beautiful Latino priestess in, you put her in this huge apartment, you fill it full of all these cartoon assassins, they've all got their own individual themes and all that kind of stuff, and then the bloodletting that's in it is just over the top.
What about the style? I mean, what he does with the camera, he goes in and out of the apartment all in one shot. So I don't know if you recall, there's a scene where the camera goes out the window all the way down to the footpath, in the door, and then up again. Yeah. Like, it's all in one take. Cool. It's fucking really amazing.
Cool. It harkens back in 1998, there was a guy, Skip Woods, who nowadays is predominantly a screenwriter.
Right.
His biggest thing that he wrote was Swordfish, amongst other things, right? But back in 1998, he directed his first film. It was called Thursday.
Amazing film.
So Tom Jane, Mickey Rourke, there's all...
And that little nerdy guy from bloody Jurassic Park 3. The guy with the mustache.
Yeah, he's actually dead now. He died.
Yeah, I know.
It was the same kind of idea. He's this ex-gangster who's trying to move on with his life, and then one day an old friend shows up, which is played by Aaron Eckhart, long before he became famous. And over the course of a day, in this one house, his life falls apart while all these old guys from his past come and visit him looking for a bag of drugs.
A film that's most notorious for its unconventional rape scene. It's just
really bizarre rape scene, But when I was watching Everly, I remember thinking, Everly is like the next generation of Thursday.
I can see that.
It takes everything that worked with Thursday and just throws it in it hyperbole. Yeah. So
it's just never boring. I think, just the way they can hold your attention in one location and be just on the whole time.
Yeah.
It doesn't relent.
Yeah.
I just think, like you said, it came unannounced. There was no marketing behind it. DVD cover was pretty shit.
Yeah.
It was striking, though. It was very stark.
It wasn't off-putting.
Yeah.
But it certainly was misleading.
I agree.
And it kind of had a Femme Nikita kind of look to it, too.
Yeah, the beautiful babe with a gun.
It almost had that Desperado look, but with Selma Hayek.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Which, I mentioned it's sort of like Machete in the way it approaches the violence. And that's kind of the connection to that. But,
so these are two good companion pieces from 2014, fast-paced, obscurities that have,
funny action comedies.
Yeah. Technically, films that probably should have been, bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this, look, to come from Joe Lynch, the guy that did Wrong Turn 2, it's a really unlikely and unexpected film.
In my opinion, the best of the Wrong Turn sequels.
Yeah.
That was the one with Henry Rollins.
I would go number four, but...
Oh my God, number four was fucking... Strainer.
Yeah.
If you say so.
I only watched
number
it recently.
Two felt like a trauma film.
Really? I liked number two. I thought it looked pretty slick.
To be honest, I don't like Adam Sandler. I can't believe we're debating Wrong Turn. Like,
Glenn's
like,
probably the only one that's watched them all.
I've watched them all. I didn't think much of them after part one, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Same. But you got to take two through onwards to six Declan, on their own.
Declan planet. O'Brien, he was the guy behind us.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
So, tell us, what was your...
So mine...
Was it from 2014?
No, it wasn't. Mine was from 2000. And for once, something you said last week actually struck me when I did my my obscurity, or my forgotten gem, or whatever it was, which was Kevin Costner's Revenge. You said, you goes, oh, it's an action thriller. And I thought, he's right. I never do... dramas. Like, I've got a list of dramas, like obscure dramas.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, I'm like, what am I going to talk about? And I sort of trolled through all my stuff and I thought about talking about
Music of the Heart.
I was actually, do you know what I was actually going to do? I was going to do Adrian Shelley's Waitress.
Oh, have really?
Yeah. Yeah, have you seen
that? Oh, my God, it's tragic, film. If you think about the circumstance of.
It's actually fine.
Well, teasers.
Yeah. So, anyway, so I decided I'm going to go for a drama. 2000. Stars Damon Wayans.
Drama with Wayans. Damon Wayans.
It also stars Jada Pinkett Smith.
Oh, not Jason's Lyric, no.
No.
No, she wasn't even in that. Neither of them were in that.
I'm not going to say anything.
No. Shut up, Glenn.
It was shot in New York. So think about it. We got a predominantly African American.
I think the silence suggests that we are thinking about
directed by Spike Lee.
Oh, I was going to say, was it directed by Spike Lee, given the New York setting?
Oh, No Money.
No, that wasn't Spike Lee. That would have been the.
Mo Money was Spike Lee.
Mo Money's a
classic.
That's not Spike Lee.
Mo Money?
It's a comedy from 1993.
This is the worst conversation I've had this week.
Yeah, I know. It's really good. All right, I'll tell you. Bamboozled.
Oh yes,
I rented it out. I didn't get around to watching it.
You said drama. That's a comedy to me.
Well, it's a comedy drama. It's a really bizarre film because
really low grade for Spike Lee.
Really low.
Is it period?
Yeah. No, it's not. Contemporary, right? So the idea is that the plot goes like this. Damon Wayans plays a TV writer called Pierre Delacroix. Right, who writes for studio executive Michael Rapaport. And Michael Rapaport is this, like, the ultimate wigger. You know, like, I'm probably more black than you. And, like, the guy's like a fucking milk bottle. And Pierre Delacroix gets really upset with this, you know, blurring of the racial lines. He doesn't think that his people are getting, you know, the justice that they deserve or the recognition that they deserve. And he decides that he's going to make a new show about minstrels. Right. Which he's doing this because he's locked in a contract. He can't get out of his contract unless he's fired. So he convinces this wigger that a minstrel show is the way to go, with the intention that the world will be so outraged that he will end up being fired and be released from his contract.
Yeah.
The problem is, it ends up being the biggest TV show the world's ever seen.
Yeah.
Right, which then sets in motion this scenario where, you know, the new generation of black activists get really upset at him. He's having to battle his friends and family and all that kind of stuff, and his life kind of spirals out of control. Now, it's interesting you should say that you think it's a comedy, because the film is particularly long. It's about two hours, 10 minutes, right? And the first hour, there are some hilarious moments.
Yeah.
Hilarious moments. And then when the shit hits the fan, about the hour mark, and we watch Pierre Delacroix's life fall to pieces, it becomes this
tragedy
of epic proportions, where in true Spike Lee fashion, he takes all these elements, you know, along with longtime collaborator Terrence Blanchard's score, and it just becomes this cacophony of violence and sound and movement and velocity. It's really powerful stuff. Now, the reason that it's an obscurity is because it was released straight to video here. Right?
I was about to ask about that, because I thought it was actually a made for television because he did two TV movies. The other one was Get on the Bus.
Sucker Free City as well.
Was this?
But he didn't direct that, did he? Yeah, that was a pilot episode, wasn't it?
No, he directed it.
Was that through Miramax TV that he did this? Or?
Yeah, it was. It was at the end. It was the end of the sort of Miramax independent movement in the '90s, and it was also when digital video was on its way in, and it was also in its infancy. Not HD, DV.
It was also the end of Spike Lee as well.
Yeah, it was. It was getting towards the end. You know, he had a couple of upward blips.
He tapped out. Like he I think he'd milked the race thing far too heavily and it was running out of mojo.
Yeah, maybe that's why he moved on to like 25th Hour came afterwards and that was really good.
And that's racial too.
Summer of Sam
but they're, before it.
But they're very racially aimed as well, but not African American.
Yeah.
Like they tackle all the other races.
Absolutely, you know? Latinos.
Even Inside Man, which was a very like untypical Spike Lee film.
Yeah.
But anyway, so this film became an obscurity and it's very easy to see why it became an obscurity. Like I say, it was shot in digital video, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't shot by his longtime collaborator and friend Ernest Dickerson. It was actually shot by a woman. But the digital video, the DV, not the HD, the DV aesthetic is really abrasive.
Yeah.
Right? It's like there's moments where it's like he just has 16 DV cameras and he just sets it up for coverage with no design or style or anything like that.
It's kind of like when Soderbergh goes off rail and does stuff like Full Frontal, you know, those really small ones.
Yeah, even smaller than that. Maybe Bubble would be the closer one. And there's moments where the camera's not even like framed properly. People are barely in frame, right? So we're watching a really lo-fi film with a kind of off-center theme, and it's easy to see why people didn't gravitate towards it, right? However, that's not to say it's a bad film, because in my opinion, it's a very good film, right? It's got that same Spike Lee, he's obviously got a bone to pick, he's got an axe to grind, he's got some teeth and he's got to set them in, and the message of the film is crystal clear, even if the visuals aren't. If you haven't seen it, it's well worth it. It's a really interesting exercise.
Just
down there behind you. But it's an odd experiment, particularly from somebody who's got such a profile as Spike Lee. And some things really work. Like I say, the story works, the themes work. Spike Lee can tell the story, but not necessarily all the performances work.
Yeah.
Pierre Delacroix, Damon Wayans portrayal of this guy is this kind of obnoxious, lispy, high-pitched voice, like he's just wandered in from another fucking film. Like,
bulletproof.
it was really bizarre. Michael Rapaport kind of half works, but kind of doesn't work. Right. The supporting cast really work. The guys who play the minstrels, Sleepin' Eatin' Mantan, are their names. They're phenomenal, right? Yeah. Jada Pinkett Smith, she's really good. The social activists, they're all really good. The score is great. Cinematography's terrible. It really is a film, a dichotomy of what works and what doesn't. Yeah. I think it just creeps over the line into that it works. It's well worth seeing.
It's the one Spike Lee film you just don't remember when you talk about Spike Lee. It's the one that gets left out of conversation, and that definitely makes it obscure.
Yeah, I agree. But, if you haven't seen it, it's well worth it. Like I say, just as an exercise of watching one of the big titans try something a little off-center.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's mine. Bamboozled from 2000.
Stegman doesn't play another people's asshole band.
All right, boys, let's bring this baby to an end.
This is it again.
We sound so burnt out.
What happened?
Jarrett's got reason to be burnt out because he was on fire.
I slept during the bamboozle part.
like most of the other people that watch the fucking film.
I do want to watch it now,
Do you want to add anything before we...
No, sir, I don't think I should hold this proceeding up. I think it's probably been a very epic podcast.
It has been.
We're all very enthused about our obscurities.
Yeah, I think so. I want to end it with a competition. So what I'm going to do is I've got some Blu-rays to give away. I want to get rid of some Eagle stock. I want to get rid of some Umbrella stock. And 5 Blu-rays are up for grabs. We're going to end this podcast with a song. And if you can pair the song with the film, send us an email to just glenn@fakechamp.net. That'll do. And if you get it right, you get the Blu-rays. Got to be the first one in, though.
Can I choose a song?
No.
Why not?
Huh? I don't know.
No, this is his baby. But he was going to put it to an end. All I got when he said that, I had this smothering of a small child that scared me. I'm like,
what?
Don't let him babysit. Oh, the intro to this segment, you said, let's put this baby to an end, and I'm like, oh my god,
smothering children to rest.
What is your, what, it's all the Jungle Book, I think. It's the Jungle Book imagery.
I think I conclude every episode with that phrase.
Yeah.
So you've just come to that conclusion now.
Might have been after the talk of the Jungle Book screening.
Oh, right. And me wanting to open fire on a cinema full of children.
Someone's going to die and they're going to be under 10.
Yeah. Not much of a promise.
Maybe your, just the mothers.
What's your big one that you're looking forward to this week? What film are you looking forward to the most?
This week?
Well, between now and the next podcast.
Oh, geez. I don't really look forward to that many films. I sort of take them as they come, and I don't have anything lined up that I'm really particularly
there's something coming out April 28th that I don't know what it is, but I know the date, like it's in my head. I know that I actually do want to check out the new Melissa McCarthy film, The Boss. I'm not a massive fan of her,
great props. Had,
yeah, but I did really like Spy. I thought that was great, and again it looks like this role isn't super typical Melissa McCarthy. It looks like there's a little bit of, you know...
You know, I like
she's
it
playing
when,
a character.
I like it when her and her husband work together. Even though Tammy wasn't a great film, and it was a very pastiche kind of film.
Yeah.
No, but it had so many good moments.
Didn't
it was
40 minutes, I turned it off. And that was after I watched Spy. Because I mean, Spy was really good. And then I watched Tammy, 40 minutes. I'm like, fucking this
Tammy
is,
like a sketch movie. Like, it's full of ideas, but it doesn't have a cohesive narrative.
Mm.
Yeah.
Anyway. I just don't like her. The only reason I got through the Heat was because I got a
couldn't get through
hated
that either.
I've got a 30 minutes. Huge crush on Sandra Bullock.
I will watch that girl
read a phone book. But other than that, like it was, she's Melissa McCarthy still got to prove herself.
I think she's proved herself. I think she's pretty awesome.
She actually just received she's the first comedian to receive the MTV Comedian of the Year Award at MTV Movie Awards, which is pretty cool. That's she did address and said, it's not that I am the funniest woman, it's like, you know, I'm the first one to be recognized, and there's a lot of, and she paid
and
tribute
she thanked
to
all
this.
The others,
absolutely. I was like, fucking massive respect.
Well, I think
for
the interesting thing about her is right now at this point in her career she's finally breaking free. Like, she's been sort of pigeonholed into this character, and she's had to ride that train, like, you know,
of course,
it's a lot of money in that, and now she's starting to just sort of become an original.
And she thinks fast. She's fast on her feet when she does the acceptance speech. She's like this, thinking of things. She's fast-witted. Other thing that I really appreciate about her too is, like this character with this movie, The Boss. This is a character she's been wanting to do for, I think she must have done it on, I don't know, a sketch comedy show or a stand-up or something like that.
It was her improv act.
Like over, you know, I don't know, 11 years or
back
something.
Back at the Groundlings, she used to perform this on stage.
Oh, really?
And there's footage of her doing it, and you'd think it was from yesterday. Like,
oh, really?
You know, compared to the trailer that we've seen.
Yeah,
of course.
But I wasn't expecting to talk about Melissa McCarthy at the end of this episode.
I thought of another one. April 21st is Midnight Special, which you've just done a review for, and to maybe give it a plug.
It's fantastic. Yeah, well, I'm writing now for realword.net, and that was my first review for them. And I do have to use a star rating for that particular website, and I gave it 8 out of 10. I think it's fucking amazing.
Hanging.
I can't wait. Yeah, the guy hasn't put a foot wrong.
If you can
so far.
Think of a really gritty version of Firestarter, very Spielbergian in its aesthetic, then you're going to get a lot out of it.
Is it half as good as Mud?
Yeah, Mud's a phenomenal film. But like Mud was a throwback to stuff like Stand By Me in a way, that kind
absolutely.
Of coming of age.
Yeah.
This is that same kind of throwback to the Spielberg type of coming of age.
The human drama side of science fiction.
Yeah. And the science fiction is secondary to the human drama.
I love that.
Good.
I'm not going to tell you anything other than the special effects are amazing. There's one particular sequence which they've shown already on television that's just phenomenal. Yeah, it's like a set piece for the film.
Can I take a pun and guess what your most anticipated movie of the month might be?
What's that?
Opening April 21st, Eddie the Eagle.
Oh, for
sure. Sore point for Glenn. He's watched the trailer before every film he's seen recently.
Will
you watch this movie now?
I'm over it. The last 20 films I reckon I've seen Eddie and the Eagle, and I've gone to new opening films. Like, this opens this week. Good, I'm going to get new trailers. Boom! Ed of the Eagle. And now Channel 10 are doing the Angela Bishop. Eddie and the Eagle is the feel-good movie of the year.
Oh,
and it's like, it doesn't make me feel good. It makes me feel violent. And
he's so angry about it.
So angry.
I love it.
Between the kids and no Angela Bishop, like, nobody's safe.
So I might wait for it.
Yeah.
Or the mood might strike me and I'll just go to the local Croydon cinemas and watch it by myself, because they don't tend to attract many people midweek. So
fair enough.
It's probably the way to do it. I saw Lady in the Van. That was great.
I heard you.
So it was good.
Way better than
this one yet, right?
Way better than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Way different to what I thought it was going to be.
Right.
It's impressive.
Cool.
Yeah.
I fancy that. Yeah, Jungle Book is my big one.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Well, that's it.
And there's a movie opening on April 28th that I don't know what it is. I'm looking forward to it.
Keep us posted on that.
Yeah. I think by the time we do the next podcast, I'll have seen it and I'll be able to tell you a bit about it then.
We won't remember. No way.
All right. So we're going to play a song. Email me, glenn@fakechamp.net, guess the movie and win stuff. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who are you thanking? Us or them?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.